From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Trying to basically move towards state-sanctioned journalism. They're trying to say that I'm not a journalist, and even if I was, the journalists aren't protected, in order to basically force journalists to act as agents for the state.
Journalist Josh Wolf has spent almost 6 months in jail, more time than any journalist in U.S. history for protecting his sources. In national broadcast exclusive, he speaks to us from prison. We'll also speak with his attorney, Martin Garvis. Then, news war.
Reporters are under attack.
We have a press that is at war with an administration, while our country is at war against merciless enemies.
They are seeking subpoenas and going after people in cases where they would never have done it, even 2 years ago.
A new Frontline documentary looks at secret spin and the future of the news. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. military officials are accusing the highest levels of the Iranian government of sending sophisticated roadside bombs to Iraq that have killed 170 coalition troops since 2004. On Sunday, reporters in Baghdad received an unusual briefing on the allegations. The news conference was led by three U.S. military officials who refused to be quoted by name. No TV cameras or tapes were allowed in, and journalists' cell phones were taken away before they entered the briefing room. Iran is denying the charges. One Iranian official said, quote, "We ask those who are claiming such evidence show the documents in public." The allegations first appeared on Saturday in a front-page New York Times article written by Michael Gordon entitled, "Deadliest Bomb in Iraq is Made by Iran," U.S. says. The article relied almost entirely on unnamed government sources. Several media critics compared the piece to Gordon's articles from 2002, alleging Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Meanwhile, Newsweek is reporting at least one former White House official contends some Bush advisors secretly want an excuse to attack Iran. The administration's former National Security Council director for Iran and Persian Gulf Affairs, Hillary Mann, said, quote, "They intend to be as provocative as possible and make the Iranians do something America would be forced to retaliate for." Newsweek is also reporting the U.S. is likely to send a third Navy carrier to the Persian Gulf. This comes as the Guardian newspaper reports U.S. preparations for an airstrike against Iran have reached an advanced stage. The present military buildup in the Gulf War would allow the U.S. to mount an attack by the spring. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports at a recent meeting, Vice President Cheney's National Security Advisor John Hanna said 2007 is, quote, "the year of Iran." Illinois Senator Barack Obama has formally launched his presidential campaign. If elected, the Illinois Democrat would be the country's first African-American president. On Saturday, Senator Obama addressed thousands of supporters at the old state capitol in Springfield, Illinois, the site of Abraham Lincoln's famous House Divided speech against slavery in 1858. Senator Obama called for the withdrawal of all U.S. combat troops by March 2008.
Most of you know that I opposed this war from the start. I thought it was a tragic mistake. Today we grieve for the families who have lost loved ones, the hearts that have been broken, and the young lives that could have been. America, it is time to start bringing our troops home. It's time to admit that no amount of American lives can resolve the political disagreement that lies at the heart of someone else's civil war.
Senator Obama's call for withdrawal of U.S. troops was quickly attacked by Bush ally, Australian Prime Minister John Howard.
If I were running al-Qaeda in Iraq, I would put a circle around March 2008 and pray as many times as possible for a victory not only for Obama but also for the Democrats.
Senator Obama quickly responded.
Mr. Howard may have quibbles with our intelligence estimates. Maybe he has better ones. I would also note that we have close to 140,000 troops on the ground now, and my understanding is that Mr. Howard has deployed 1,400. So if he's ginned up to fight the good fight in Iraq, I would suggest that he calls up another 20,000 Australians.
In other political news, Democratic presidential candidate Senator Hillary Clinton is continuing to refuse to acknowledge she made a mistake in voting for the Iraq War Saturday during a town hall meeting in New Hampshire. A local resident named Roger Tilton questioned her.
I want to know if right here, right now, once and for all, without nuance, you can say that that war authorization vote was a mistake. And the reason I want to ask is because a lot of other senators have already done so, including some Republicans and including one of your competitors, Senator Edwards. And the reason I ask personally is because I, and I think a lot of other Democratic primary voters, until we hear you say that, we're not going to hear all these other great things you're saying.
Well, I have said, and I will repeat it, that knowing what I know now, I would never have voted for it. But I also, and I mean, obviously you have to weigh everything as you make your decisions. I have taken responsibility for my vote. The mistakes were made by this president who misled this country and this Congress into a war that should not have been waged.
Senator Hillary Clinton speaking in New Hampshire. In Iraq, at least 80 people died earlier today in three bombings in central Baghdad. 150 others were injured. The blasts occurred on the first anniversary of the bombing of the important Shia Golden Dome Shrine in Samarra. One of the bombs blew up today shortly after the Iraqi government called for a 15-minute period of silence to commemorate last year's bombing. On Capitol Hill, the House begins debate today on a non-binding resolution opposing President Bush's escalation of the war. A vote is expected later this week. General David Petraeus has taken charge of U.S. forces in Iraq, becoming the third commander in the war. He said the American task is now to help Iraqis, quote, save the country.
The rucksack of responsibility is very heavy. In truth, it is too heavy for any one person to bear. And we will all have to share the burdens and move forward together. If we can do that, and if we can help the people of Iraq do likewise, then the prospects for success are good. Failing that, Iraq will be doomed to continued violence and civil strife, and surely that is a prospect that all must strive to avoid.
Meanwhile, the former head of the National Security Agency is warning victory is no longer an option in Iraq. Writing in the Washington Post, General William Odom said the Bush administration must recognize fighting unsimply prolongs U.S. losses and blocks the way to a new strategy. Odom writes, getting out of Iraq is the precondition for creating new strategic options. Odom also accuses the Bush administration of pushing policies that are destabilizing the Middle East. Democratic Senator Carl Levin has announced plans to continue to investigate how dubious intelligence linking Saddam Hussein to the September 11th attacks became part of the justification for the 2003 invasion of Iraq. On Friday, the Pentagon's inspector general accused former Pentagon official Douglas Feith of inappropriately manipulating intelligence on Iraq. On Sunday, Feith appeared on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace.
Nobody in my office ever said there was an operational relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda. It's just not correct. I mean, words matter. And people are throwing around loose allegations, vague allegations, based on not reading the words carefully.
Mr. Feith, I'm just taking comments from your PowerPoint. You said some indications of possible Iraqi coordination with al-Qaeda specifically related to 9/11. You said that the Atta-Ani meeting in Prague in 2001 was a known contact.
The people who did that briefing were taking the position that the intelligence community took originally. The CIA later changed its views on that meeting after the time relevant here.
Douglas Feith speaking on Fox News Sunday. U.S. forces in eastern Afghanistan have launched artillery rounds into Pakistan, reportedly in an effort to strike Taliban forces. The attack came just ahead of a visit to Pakistan by Defense Secretary Robert Gates. He's meeting with Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf. Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh of Hamas says his government plans to step down as early as this week, following the agreement by Hamas and Fatah to form a coalition government. Haniyeh will retain the post of prime minister. Harvard University has named Drew Gilpin Faust as the school's new president. Faust is the first woman to head the university in its more than 350-year history. She's a noted scholar of the American South and was dean of Harvard's Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. Half of the 8 Ivy League schools are now run by women. British billionaire Richard Branson has offered a $25 million prize for the scientist who discovers a way to extract greenhouse gases from the atmosphere.
Al Gore, James Lovelock, Jim Hansen, Sir Crispin Tickell, Tim Flannery, and myself are laying down to the world's brightest brains is to devise a way of removing greenhouse gases, at least the equivalent of 1 billion tons of carbon per year, and hopefully much more. And you will have the satisfaction of saving thousands of species, and possibly even mankind itself.
Richard Branson made the announcement alongside former Vice President Al Gore.
It's a challenge to the moral imagination of humankind to actually accept the reality of the situation we're now facing.
Egyptian authorities have released from prison a Muslim cleric who was kidnapped off the streets of Italy by CIA agents 3 years ago. The cleric, Abu Ammar, was abducted as part of the Bush administration's program known as Extraordinary Rendition. The cleric has accused Egyptian agents of beating and torturing him with electric shocks. In Somalia, at least 3 people have died after 5 mortar bombs struck northern Mogadishu overnight. Several homes were flattened in the attacks. The U.S. government is resuming broadcast today of Somali language programs in the Horn of Africa for the first time in 13 years. One Somali website criticized the broadcast as a tool for the U.S. to disseminate propaganda and a, quote, means of promoting U.S. foreign policy based on pure colonialism. The Voice of America programs are beginning as the U.S. military expands its presence in Africa. The United States recently backed Ethiopia's invasion of Somalia, and U.S. fighter planes have bombed Somalia at least twice since January. Last week, President Bush announced the Pentagon would create a new African command to coordinate U.S. military operations throughout the continent. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has agreed to pay about $3 million to help repair the former home of Confederate President Jefferson Davis. Davis led the Confederacy in the South during the Civil War. Hurricane Katrina nearly destroyed the 150-year-old home in Biloxi, Mississippi. Meanwhile, in New Orleans, low-income residents are still fighting to prevent their homes from being demolished. On Saturday, some residents of the Central City Public Housing Complex defied government orders and moved back into their old apartments. The city's planning to demolish 4 large public housing developments, even though tens of thousands of low-income New Orleans residents remain displaced. And in South Africa, thousands gathered Saturday for the funeral of longtime anti-apartheid leader and freedom fighter Adelaide Tambo. She died recently at the age of 77. At her funeral, former South African President Nelson Mandela said, quote, "She was a mother to the liberation movement in exile and a nationally revered figure in our new nation." Her late husband, Oliver Tambo, led the African National Congress in exile. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, a Democracy Now! Exclusive, an interview with jailed independent journalist Josh Wolf. Wolf has been in prison for more than 170 days. He has spent most amount of time in jail for protecting his sources than any journalist in U.S. history. Josh Wolf is 24 years old. He was jailed on August 1st of last year when he refused to turn over video that he'd shot of an anti-G8 demonstration in San Francisco to a federal grand jury. Wolf had sold some of the footage to the nightly news as well as posted some on his website. The news broadcast attracted the attention of local and federal law enforcement agents who were investigating clashes between police and protesters. They later served Wolf a federal subpoena requiring he turn over his unpublished video footage as well as testify about the protesters seen on tape. When Wolf refused to comply, he was charged with contempt of court and incarcerated. Wolf's imprisonment has prompted outcries by advocates for freedom of the press who say it's out of proportion to the scale of the investigation. Lucy Morella of Reporters Without Borders has stated this is one more example of the increasing attacks on confidentiality of sources in the United States, one more blow to investigative journalism and eventually to the right for American people to be informed. This is a bad signal sent to the rest of the world, she said. On Friday, we spoke with Josh Wolf from his jail cell in Dublin, California. I began by asking him why he's in prison.
I'm here for refusing to comply with a subpoena demanding that I both testify and turn over a tape of a protest that occurred on July 8th, 2005.
Why are you refusing to comply?
Well, there's a number of reasons. It's been viewed that the tape is central to the issue, but it's also the testimony. Essentially, what the government wants me to do, as we can tell, is to identify civil dissidents who were attending this march, who were in mask and clearly did not want to be identified, but whose identities I may know some of as their contacts that I've been following in documenting civil dissent in the San Francisco Bay Area for some 2.5 years now.
A U.S. Attorney Kevin Ryan's office says they're investigating whether protesters tried to torch a police car. Ryan's spokesperson Luke McCauley said the grand jury needs the video to, quote, determine what, if any, crimes were committed. Your response?
Well, my response is that we've offered to turn the video over to the judge to review in camera to determine whether or not there is any evidence on the tape. The U.S. Attorney's Office has said that that would not be appropriate because there's certain information that only the grand jury is privy to. I don't understand why the grand jury information can't be then passed on to the judge, who can balance all these factors and determine whether or not there is any evidence on the tape, which I contend to this day there isn't, because all newsworthy material on the video was put out online at the night of the incident, because I had no idea this was going to all bubble up when I was shooting the video that night and editing it down later on.
Explain what happened that day in 2005. What was the protest you were covering?
The protest was against the G8 summit, which was going on in Glen Eagle, Scotland at the time. It started in the Mission—it was actually completely in the Mission District of San Francisco. There was probably about 100 people, mostly anarchists. It was facilitated by a group called Anarchist Action. And they proceeded to walk through the streets. There was some minor property damage, some spray painting, that sort of thing, dragging newspaper stands into the streets. At some point in time, the police, kind of the tactical police squad, backed off, and the main police didn't seem to be around. At that point, a lone squad car that was just patrolling the neighborhood proceeded to accelerate into the crowd. This is what set off the issues that have since become so explosive, because shortly after the car rammed into the crowd, they took off and tackled two individuals. I happened to be witnessing and filming one who was being choked, and you could see it on my videotape. The other individual, the other cop that took off, I don't really know what happened because I was following the one. The cop that I wasn't filming was apparently struck in the head during some sort of an altercation, and at some point, allegedly by the U.S. attorney, someone threw some sort of a firework 4 days after the 4th of July in the vicinity of the cop car, although when I walked past the cop car, I certainly didn't see any flames protruding, and the damage report shows that there wasn't really any damage to the cop car beyond a broken taillight.
Josh Wolf, why aren't you protected by California Shield law that protects journalists?
I am protected by the California Shield law. This isn't in California state court, though. This is in federal court, and the federal government does not acknowledge any sort of federal protections for journalists.
How did this end up in federal court?
The government contends that there's a statute that says that because the San Francisco Police Department gets money from the government for training against terrorism and other stuff like that, that any property belonging to the San Francisco Police Department is of federal interest, and therefore this is a federal offense that they're investigating. But clearly this seems like an attempt to sort of circumvent the protections that California feels are due to journalists in order to prevent the situation that I'm currently dealing with at this moment.
Josh, what has been the response of the journalistic community in this country to your incarceration?
It's difficult for me to gauge what the journalistic response is. I obviously don't have internet access or anything like that in here. I do get the newspaper, and the San Francisco Chronicle's covered this story quite well. I've been told that it's been a sort of lackluster response. I'm not entirely sure why that is, but it seems to me that part of it may be that the existing news media doesn't want to acknowledge that independent journalists who don't rely on television stations or large-scale newspapers or anything like that really are an additional form of journalism that's part of the media today.
You were named, however, the Northern California 2006 Journalist of the Year by an establishment journalistic organization, the Society of Professional Journalists.
That's correct. And I've also been told that on Tuesday I was awarded the James Madison Award by the same group for online journalism.
The protests that you were covering, what do you think the government is trying to find out about the protesters?
I think that their intent is twofold, or even more than that. One thing that they're trying to do is they're trying to basically move towards state-sanctioned journalism. They're trying to say that I'm not a journalist, and even if I was, the journalists aren't protected, in order to basically force journalists to act as agents for the state. Beyond that, they're also trying to identify civil dissidents and form databases. The ACLU has uncovered numerous instances of the government trying to capture identities of people who are protesting against the government. Dissent may be patriotic, but this current administration doesn't think so, and they're doing everything to criminalize it or at least intimidate those that are engaged in it to the point that they feel that it is not safe to continue expressing their beliefs.
You have used the term, Josh, anarchist witch hunt in your blog. What do you mean?
Well, the grand jury itself is a very strange segment of the government, in that there's no attorneys, there's no judges, it's just the U.S. attorney and the grand jury. And it's my belief that what they want to do is they want to call me, have me identify the people in the video. Then any people that I'm able to identify would in turn be called in. Those people would then be forced to either go to jail for contempt or name the people in the video that they saw. Then those people would follow the same procedure, like so forth, until they had a database of everyone that was there that night. We've seen similar things happen in regards to the ELF, the Environmental Liberation Front, as well as the ALF, the Animal Liberation Front, and several Bay Area grand juries that have resulted in grand jury resistors and other people that have chosen not to resist and told what's going on.
Josh, in a January 29th court filing, federal prosecutors said that it's in your, quote, imagination that you're a journalist.
Right.
Your response?
I think it's a very scary idea that the U.S. attorney, the Justice Department, the government prosecution feels that they can determine who is and isn't a journalist. I think that's the first step towards state-sanctioned journalism, and I think it also is indicative of a world, almost a 1984 Orwellian world, that I don't think we want to live in. As far as whether or not I'm a journalist in my imagination, the New York Times has said I'm a journalist. The Society of Professional Journalists has awarded me an award as a journalist. Countless media outlets have said I'm a journalist. So if it's my imagination and other journalists' imagination, then who decides what is and isn't a journalist? The government?
Jail journalist Josh Wolf speaking to us from the Federal Correctional Institution in Dublin, California. We'll be back with him in a minute.
Teacher, teacher, did you not behave? Did you teach the children war is not okay? Why are you packing up your stuff? Did they ship you out to shut you up? What's happening here? Soldier, soldier, did you lose a limb? Based on a rich man's will, where are all your benefits? Did they fund the tax cuts for the rich? What's happening here?
What's happening here, Jamie Green? Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to the Federal Correctional Institution in Dublin, California, to the interview with jailed journalist Josh Wolf. He has spent the most amount of time in jail for protecting his sources than any journalist in history, almost 6 months. I asked him to describe what his time has been like in prison.
Yeah, it's getting very close to 6 months. I've probably read about 60 books. I've written some 300, 400 letters in response to things that have come into me. I've written hundreds of pages in my journal, wrote in numerous blog entries, played a lot of dominoes, exercised, ate and slept. And that's basically all that one can do inside of a prison environment. I've socialized with the inmates, gotten a better understanding of the justice system, made some good friends and acquaintances.
Who is imprisoned along with you?
Well, for one thing, Greg Anderson, who's also in contempt for regarding the Balco case, he's there.
Explain who Greg Anderson is.
Greg Anderson is Barry Bonds' trainer who's refused to testify in the grand jury that's investigating whether or not Barry Bonds lied under oath in the grand jury. So he's there in the unit. There's a number of drug dealers, felons with guns, illegal immigrants. That's one of the most frightening things, is a lot of the people there have done nothing more than cross an imaginary line, and that's their crime, and they're often given 3, 4, 5 years before being deported, which is just unbelievable.
Have you been able to interview them?
I've spoken to them at length. I recently wrote something about my understanding of their situation, which I believe is on my blog right now.
And how are the guards, how is the prison treating you?
With a level of professionality that I did not expect, not just in terms of myself, who's clearly here for a different sort of situation than other people, but also in terms of just all of the prisoners that are here. I was kind of quite surprised that there is this, you know, professional courtesy given towards the inmates, but I've been told that that's one of the major differences between the federal and state systems of incarceration.
Josh Wolf, why did you go to the protests that day in July of 2005?
To document a demonstration that the news media was almost certainly likely to ignore.
At this point, after being imprisoned for almost 6 months, are you sorry you went?
I'm not sorry at all I went. Had I known that the FBI was going to subpoena my footage in this way, and given the fact that I knew there was nothing on it, I may have been a smarter practice from henceforth to take all of my material and put it online and say, complete video, edited video, and then there would have been no need to subpoena the footage. That may be a best practice. Perhaps a better practice is, once I finish editing a video, to destroy the master footage.
What kind of effect has your imprisonment had on your family?
It's been very frustrating for my mother. Clearly, she, you know, doesn't want her son to be in jail, especially for 6 months now. There's been some difficulties with the home situation in that, you know, here I am not able to pay my rent and having to rely on other people to take care of that. That sort of situation is quite stressful. But everyone's very supportive. Both my mother and father have been behind me 110%, and they know that I'm doing the right thing and have my back for it.
Josh, I know we don't have much more time in this conversation, which is limited to 15 minutes, but I was just looking at your blog and the poem you wrote, The Alarm Clock. Do you remember it off the top of your head?
I don't remember it off the top of my head.
Well, your last lines, I am an alarm clock. I am sounding the alarm like Paul Revere did years ago. I'm riding down the lane screaming, wake up. Do you think your imprisonment is having that effect?
I'd like to think it's having that effect, but my fear is that instead of having the effect of making people wake up and realize that we need to do something about the impending police state that we're living in, that'll send a journalist to jail for 6 months who's done who was accused of doing nothing wrong, that instead of causing people to stand up, that it's scaring people into not speaking out at all. And that's a very frightening concept that reminds me of what happened during World War II or the lead-up to World War II in Germany, and that all these people saw what was coming their way and could have decided to react, to resist, but were too afraid. And I'm worried that America is too afraid, and even though maybe my situation has helped them realize what's coming down the pike, that instead of jolting them out of bed, it's just lulled them deeper into sleep and helped them pull the covers over their head in the hopes that maybe, just maybe, if they don't see it, it'll all go away.
How much longer will you be jailed?
I'll be jailed until the judge, William Alsup, decides to say he's not going to give in. We have to let him go.
Could it be indefinitely that you're held?
It's not likely to be indefinitely. Civil contempt lasts the length of the grand jury with a maximum of 18 months. And the grand jury expires in July, but then can be extended for 6 more months. So the longest that I would be likely to be here would be about 18 months total. About a year from now is when I'd be, worst case, likely to be released. But then, of course, there is also the possibility that they'll bring criminal contempt charges against me, and there really is no limitations to the penalties for criminal contempt. And theoretically, God forbid, I could face life imprisonment. But I don't really see that happening. I certainly am optimistic that that won't happen.
Are you afraid?
At this point, the whole thing's become so bizarre that there is some fear that they are going to go that far. But I have hope that basically that a jury wouldn't convict me of criminal contempt after having been through this, and that a judge wouldn't decide to take such a ridiculous course of action.
Do you plan to continue to be a journalist, Josh Wolf, once you are freed?
Absolutely. This has just made me more determined to get the stories that are not being covered out than ever before, because someone needs to cover this. There's a lot of people that are, but we need more. Every single person that can stand up and document injustices they see around them is one more person that'll help lead towards an understanding and enlightenment of our society about what's really going on.
If people want to reach you, where can they write? Can they email you? Can they write you letters?
If they visit my website at joshwolf.net, there's my blog that they can read about what's going on. There's a resource page that explains the situation a little better. And at the bottom, it says mail me. Right there is my address. And if you don't want to send snail mail, you can just click the email button and send an email to freejosh@joshwolf.net. And those will get printed and sent to me. But please do include your snail mail address, because I can't email you back.
And would you recommend to young journalists, of course, you're one yourself, you're how old?
I'm 24 years old.
24 years old. Would you recommend to other young people to go into journalism?
Absolutely. This has demonstrated that there are risks that we don't imagine in terms of the dangers of journalism. More experienced journalists are aware of those risks, especially covering other countries. But the stories need to be told, and the mainstream media is letting the ball slip. So we need to basically form a sort of compendium of journalists, compendium of activists who will document the world they see, get those stories out, work to get those stories picked up by the mainstream media so that they can't be ignored anymore, so that the people demand to know what's going on. And then once that happens, maybe we'll start to see some change in the mainstream journalistic front. And then from there, we'll start to see a change in the way that our government is being perpetuated.
When we interviewed you for the brief respite that you got out of jail in September, live in studio at the Link TV studios in San Francisco, we also talked to the San Francisco Chronicle reporter. Two reporters there also face imprisonment for not revealing sources and exposing the steroid Barry Bonds case, what you were talking about. But they have not gone to jail. What's the difference?
The legal difference is not much. it clearly shows how the government's deciding to deal with corporate media versus an independent journalist, is that they've said, well, we're not going to make you go to jail until the 9th District rules one way or the other. And then the 9th District's hearings have been pushed back and pushed back and pushed back. Mine, on the other hand, I was escorted into custody from the courtroom the day I was ruled in contempt. The 9th Circuit ruled while I was in custody, or actually the 9th Circuit spent a month waiting to determine whether or not to grant me bail, granted me bail, passed it on to the next panel. That panel ruled, and then immediately they said I needed to go back into custody while we still had another level of 9th Circuit appeals pending. So it's definitely a divergence between how the government's handled my situation as an independent journalist and how they've dealt with the corporate media, who has also been found in civil contempt.
U.S. Attorney spokesperson McCauley said six separate judges or panels have now ruled unequivocally that, quote, we've lawfully issued a subpoena for a legitimate investigative purposes and that the material in question should be furnished to the grand jury. What kind of faith does this give you in the system?
Unfortunately, Amy, I don't really understand that question. I've been told I need to wrap the conversation up, so I'm probably going to have to let that question go unanswered.
Well, thanks very much, Josh, for joining us. Last words to the listening and viewing audience in this country, the United States, and around the world.
Look around you. If they're sending me to jail for essentially no charges, what's next? We need to wake up. We need to come to terms with the government we have right now and demand a change, demand a free media that's not encumbered by interference, that doesn't force journalists to act as agents of the state, that truly is free both in terms of corporate control and government control. And hopefully if we demand it, we'll have it.
Imprisoned journalist Josh Wolf speaking from his jail cell at the Federal Correctional Institution, Dublin, California. He spoke to us on Friday afternoon. We asked a spokesperson for the U.S. Attorney's Office to join us on the program today. They declined our invitation, but Luke McCauley, the spokesperson for the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of California, did send a statement. It reads, quote, we have an obligation to the community to investigate and gather evidence of serious crimes. The incident under investigation so that the grand jury can determine what, if any, crimes were committed. As our court filings state, Wolf videotaped a public demonstration where there may have been an attempt to set a police car ablaze and where a San Francisco police officer's skull was fractured when he was hit from behind by a demonstrator. Six separate judges, one federal magistrate judge, two federal district court judges, and a panel of three Ninth Circuit judges have now ruled that this office has issued a lawful subpoena for legitimate investigative purposes and that the material and testimony in question should be provided to the grand jury. That was the statement from the prosecutor's office. Martin Garbus is Josh Wolf's attorney. Time magazine calls him one of the best trial lawyers in the country. The National Law Journal and Newsweek cite Martin Garbus as America's most prominent First Amendment attorney, joining us now in the Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Martin Garbus.
Thank you.
Your response to that statement?
I think that what he said, namely, that they're investigating what may have been an attempt to set fire to a police car. You don't set up grand juries in order to see whether or not there was a crime or not. You have a grand jury to investigate something that is a crime. I think the significant thing here is that the grand jury subpoena has been issued by the Joint Terrorism Task Force. So I think that you should put the Josh Wolf stuff aside in a way, namely whatever happened at that particular demonstration. I think it's an attempt to get at people who were critical of the Bush administration. There is no crime. There's no grand jury sitting right now in the state court. There is no crime being considered in the state court. The whole question of whatever happened to a policeman is a state court problem. You could not issue a subpoena out of the federal court to investigate what is a state court problem. There is no investigation of any kind going on, so far as we know, in the state court, in the federal court. So there's no reason to hold him. And we have made this argument, and the argument has been rejected.
What do you think is going on?
I think basically it's an attempt by the government. The Joint Terrorism Task Force is controlled out of Washington. I think it's an attempt, as Josh said, to learn the identity of people who are hostile to this administration. And the people who are at the demonstration, in addition to demonstrating about the subject of the demonstration, also had anti-Bush signs, also had anti-Iraq signs. Now, this subpoena was issued, as we know, early last year. I think that what you see is an attempt by the Bush administration to crack down on its critics.
Now, there is a grand jury impaneled now.
There is no grand jury impaneled in the state court, which relates to the crime about the
government. But in the federal court.
In the federal court, a grand jury was impaneled, is impaneled. So far as I know, it has not taken any evidence for the last 4 or 5 months. Now, what we did last time before Judge Alsop is we asked the government to tell us whether or not there was a grand jury taking evidence. The grand jury refused to tell us that. We then made an attempt to get discovery, to find out for ourselves if a grand jury was sitting, a federal grand jury was actually sitting and taking evidence. Judge Alsop denied that. If you represent somebody who's before the grand jury, you have very, very limited rights. The normal things that go on in a lawsuit, discovery or getting information from the government itself, you can't get.
So right now, is it possible, or how long do you foresee Josh Wolf being held? Now, it's almost been 6 months.
I think the high probability is that he'll be held certainly until July, which is supposedly the ending of this grand jury panel. Of course, the judge can extend the grand jury panel for another period of time. We'll be making a motion next month to try and get him out. The law is that once the detention time becomes punishment, then he should be released. In other words, as long as he's being held and there's some possibility that he'll give information, then the judge is right to hold him. But at the point that a judge becomes convinced that holding him any longer will not get any information, the judge is obligated to let him out. Now, this is a subjective approach, and this is a judge who's not terribly sympathetic.
Martin Garbus is a famed First Amendment attorney. We'll come back from our break and talk with him, as well as the producer of a Frontline documentary premiering tomorrow night that deals with journalists and the state. Stay with us.
I'm not sure it could. They say time heals everything, but I'm still waiting. I'm through with doubt. There's nothing left for me to figure out. I've paid a price, and I'll keep paying. I'm not ready to make nice. I'm not ready to back down. I'm still mad as hell, and I don't have time to go round and round and round. It's too late to make it right. I probably wouldn't if I could, 'cause I'm mad as hell, can't bring myself to do what it is.
Not Ready to Make Nice by the Dixie Chicks. The Texas Trio won 5 Grammys last night, including Record and Song of the Year. The comeback comes 4 years after radio giant Clear Channel yanked them off the air after they criticized President Bush publicly on the eve of the invasion of Iraq. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. A new Frontline documentary series called News Wars will begin airing on PBS tomorrow night. Part one of the series examines the political and legal forces challenging the mainstream news media. The second part looks at the legal jeopardy faced by a number of reporters across the country and interviews reporters facing jail time for refusing to reveal their sources. One of the journalists interviewed is Josh Wolfe. Frontline talked to him before he went to jail. In a moment, we'll be joined by Frontline producer Rainey Aronson. But first, let's go to an excerpt from the Frontline series, News War.
30 years ago, they were thought of as heroes.
It would have been totally impossible to have done the Watergate reporting and identified our sources.
Today, reporters are under attack.
We have a press that is at war with an administration while our country is at war against merciless enemies.
They are seeking subpoenas and going after people in cases where they would never have done it even 2 years ago.
It's time to stop the tide!
Beginning in February, Frontline correspondent Lowell Bergman takes a hard look at the news industry with a series of films that examine the tremendous change taking place in journalism today.
Would you go to jail to protect your sources?
Absolutely.
From the legal challenges to the explosion of new and emerging media and the economic realities of today's news business.
We're judging journalism by the same standards that we apply to entertainment. That may be one of the greatest tragedies in the history of American journalism.
This is also the story of the ongoing war between the press and the White House.
It was a shameful act for someone to disclose this very important program in time of war.
Of high-level secrets.
It's the President of the United States saying that if you publish this story, you will have blood on your hands.
Of undisclosed sources.
The public has a right to know. I also believe that if the reporter knows the identity of somebody who's committed a crime, the public has a right to know that just as much.
And of political spin.
I thought you were Judy Miller, the supporter of the administration, the friend of the administration.
Who says that?
The press was sold and spun and just fooled by the White House in the run-up to the war.
How did we get here?
How can one say that we have a watchdog press after a performance like that?
And what is at stake?
There's a dire need for institutions that tell the truth, that pursue the truth, and that chase it at all costs.
If people engage in activities that subvert their government and thereby help our enemies, whether you call it treason or simply unpatriotic behavior, it's a problem. The press in this country ought to be reporting as though our lives depend on it, because indeed they do.
An excerpt from the four-part Frontline series, News War, that will air tomorrow night on PBS around the country. Rainey Aronson is the producer, director, and writer of parts one and two of the series. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having us. In part two,
you also interviewed Josh Wolfe before he went back into prison. Talk about the thesis of News War, the subtitle Secret Spin, and the future of the news.
What we tried to do was actually look at the challenges facing the media right now. So we looked at it from the government angle, sort of contentious relationship with the Bush administration. And then we also looked at the legal jeopardy a number of reporters are facing right now.
Talk about some of those.
Well, it's been really interesting. I mean, if you look at the Judy Miller case, bringing the Judy Miller case to the appellate level court in the Plame affair, it really opened the doors, at least on a legal front, for the government to go after other reporters such as Josh Wolfe. So if you look at the recent rulings, it really points to that decision that sort of affirmed a case from the early 70s. And what we do is really look at this era as hearkening back to the early 70s. In other words, we haven't seen this sort of attack from the government really in about 35 years.
You also go back to the Pentagon Papers,
right,
in giving a kind of background to all of this. Explain the legal issue there.
Sure. It's a great issue. The issue that we look at in the second hour is a very big question about who has the right to publish. In other words, is it the government or the press? What the Pentagon Papers said is essentially the press has a right to publish. The question that it left open, which is the one we're looking at today, is what can the government do to the press after they publish? In other words, what is viable in terms of what they can do? And there is the option of the Espionage Act, which was left very much open in the Pentagon Papers. It's something a lot of people don't know about.
You also talk about the James Risen piece and the big article exposing the government spying on U.S. citizens. How does that fit into this scheme?
Well, it's a really good question. We have James Risen, Eric Lichtblau, and Bill Keller all talking to us from the New York Times, who talked to us very openly about a meeting that Bill Keller had with the President of the United States, in which the President asked him, along with General Hayden and others, to hold off on publishing that story. They gave him a number of reasons, and Bill Keller said that the end sort of message he got from the President was that if he published, he would have blood on his hands. Now, we also talked to Dan Bartlett.
Blood on his hands.
Mm-hmm. He goes as far as to say
that... Whose blood?
The country's blood. In other words, if the New York Times publishes the NSA wiretapping story, which the administration believes has been great in tracking terrorists, then the New York Times will have blood on its hands.
Now, the Times did hold on to that story for more than a year.
That's right.
The president had warned him, Keller, not to publish the story
That's
on the
right.
eve of the election in which President Bush was running for re-election.
Right.
So they did hold the story.
Well, actually, the way that it works in terms of a timeline is when Bill Keller actually had sat down with the president, they were just about to publish. So the holding on to the story happened in the year preceding the meeting with the president. Why they held on to the story, no one will actually talk to us frankly about. So we don't really know if it was James Risen's book or if it was simply because what Bill Keller tells us is the sources weren't,
right.
you know,
well,
up
let's
to
just
par.
Clarify. So you're saying that before the presidential election, the administration told the New York Times not to publish. They didn't. Then a year later, right before Risen is going to publish a book and expose this, even though it hasn't come out, James Risen, even though it hasn't come out in the New York Times, that's when Keller sat down with the president and then ultimately
we don't actually know if Keller had meetings himself with people in the administration beforehand. He wouldn't confirm that. So a lot of this is rumor. James Risen wouldn't talk to us about it. So we actually went to the people who were involved in it. Nobody would tell us real details about it.
Do you see a distinction between stories that are printed that expose the state versus stories like Judith Miller, where she is using unconfirmed sources, like with weapons of mass destruction, to protect the state?
Well, we actually spent quite a bit of time in our first film talking about this cozy relationship that Washington reporters now have with administration officials and how that's really changed from the 70s, where the idea of a whistleblower or someone that you would give that sort of confidential source relationship with, how it's changed and how that's a really big problem. We talked to Judy Miller about it on camera. We talked to all sorts of people about this, including Bob Woodward. We really asked some hard questions about what really is going on here. How did you guys get it wrong? What kind of relationship did you have where you didn't challenge your own sources enough?
On the eve of the invasion.
Exactly.
Martin Gorbis, in addition to being one of the leading First Amendment attorneys in this country, you have also written a book called The Next 25 Years, The New Supreme Court and What It Means for Americans. Can you put this struggle in context?
Well, I think that with respect to what was just said, I think what you saw in the Libby trial is the relationship between the present press and the government. And what you find, and Judith Mill is an example of it, and again, there was a story in today's paper where you saw an example of it, is too often the Times takes stories that the government gives out, which are not based on sufficient information, and use those as headline stories to, in a way, aid or contribute to a war mentality. They're now doing it with respect to Iraq.
Right.
Iran, pardon me. And the front page story today in the New York Times...
With Michael Gordon.
With Michael Gordon, again, is an unsourced story where nobody will talk to it, and the Times puts it right up front.
And Michael Gordon, of course, wrote some of those stories with Judith Miller in the lead-up to the invasion, alleging weapons of mass destruction.
Yes, and the question is, why doesn't the Times learn? In other words, now they're supposed to have an ombudsman who checks into what they're doing. It's amazing to see the same thing happen again. And without saying that the Times drove us to war, which would be nonsense... The Times' early editorial position was that we should go to war, and the Times' early editorial position was based on the information that Judith Miller and others were putting on the front page of the Times. So today, especially, very much of what's being said is appropriate, that the relationship between the media, where too often they act as a part of the propaganda machine for the government, is the kind of stuff that's going to get us all into trouble. And it's clear the administration is escalating to a war with Iran, and the Times is becoming part of that machine.
Where does the Supreme Court fit into this? What does the next 25 years look like?
I think the Supreme Court is not going to be adverse to the government. I think that when it comes to questions of journalism and questions of the First Amendment and question of privilege and questions of investigative reporting, this Supreme Court is going to be very anti the media. I think Roberts and Alito, who with Scalia and Thomas and Kennedy, those five people who now dominate the court, are going to be people who are going to be very, very hostile to the media. So with respect to the next 25 years, they're going to be hostile to a lot of other things. There's the famous integration case, Brown against Board of Education, and fundamentally that's going to be overruled this term.
Explain. For people, especially young people who listen to and watch this broadcast.
Okay, Brown against Board of Education said that if the state segregates a school, then a court can order integration. And the music of that case and of that case has been that we should have an integrated school system and that the government can interfere to help make a school system integrated. There was a case that two cases that were argued last December. And in those two cases, what you had was a school board, parents, voluntarily agreeing to have a school integrated. In other words, the parents themselves were saying, we want to have X percent this and Y percent that. And the Supreme Court is going to rule that unconstitutional. The Supreme Court is going to say that when parents get together and make the voluntary school board and they decide to integrate, the Supreme Court is going to say that's impermissible, that's racial classification. And what they're going to do fundamentally then is end the whole attempt to integrate schools, which started back in 1954 with Brown against Board of Ed.
Your first chapter, Martin Garbus, The President Against the People. How?
I think ultimately what the court's also going to do is they're going to extend the whole question of the unitary presidency. They're going to give Bush or whatever president follows a great deal of power. Roberts and Alito, again, and Scalia and Thomas believe that the president has sole control over foreign affairs, that the president, as commander-in-chief, gets all kind of powers. And with respect to the past decisions that we've had with Guantanamo, et cetera, you had O'Connor there, who was basically a ballast. And I think you're going to find the court making very, very different decisions now with respect to Iraq-related issues.
And state religion against the people?
I think that's one of the major areas. Bush's faith-based initiative has resulted in more money going into the churches this year than have gone on in the entire last century. It's an enormous money flow. I have a case now where we're challenging it in New York with respect to the Salvation Army. What a faith-based initiative means is that the federal government can pour money into religious organizations if the religious organizations are doing the kinds of work that a state organization could do. For example, if the Salvation Army is taking care of children or homeless, then they're also allowed to proselytize using federal funds.
We're going to have to leave it there. Martin Garbus is author of The Next 25 Years, The New Supreme Court and What It Means for Americans. Raimi Aronson is the producer of the Frontline documentary series that begins tomorrow night called News War. And that does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire, Fogo Kudus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Rubrich, and Aramate, Jen Yutz, and Nagara, Anurata Bhagwati, Megan Whitney, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Nagara, our engineers. We have a TV producer job open. Go to our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.